Hello? Excuse me, do you have a black thing on your back? I'm looking for a way in.
Oh, fuck off.
Please, come home with me. There's a better place for me.
Okay, so I'm here with Catherine M. Valente, who is most recently the author of Palimpsest. Cat, how are you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. First off, I should note that due to a technical error, we are essentially reproducing this conversation. So if we do sound stilted, I may throw in a few random questions that have nothing to do with your book during the course of this
conversation. Oh,
it's postmodern. Yes, it's postmodern, absolutely. Let's talk, first of all, about the four compartmentalized character perspectives. There are a number of interesting qualities to this. The fact that you have different colors attached to each particular character. The fact that each character also has a different relationship to reading. And there's also this notion of none of the characters really meeting up until the very end of the novel. So I'm curious as to how you went about compartmentalizing, and perhaps you can talk a little bit about the structure of the book and how the structure essentially dictated the events that followed within the course of your book.
Sure. Well, I'm fascinated by structure. I always have been. The Orphan's Tales, which was my previous book, had a very complex structure. And to some extent, starting out with Palimpsest was quite difficult because all of a sudden I didn't have the structure of the novel I'd been working on for 5 years. Got very used to working in the Arabian Nights Orphan's Tale structure, then all of a sudden I didn't have it. But I am always fascinated by very tight POV, and I knew I wanted to have four points of view characters. Western culture is very into three as a number and as a sacred number, and Eastern culture is much more attached to four and eight. So the book is separated into sections of four and eight. There are four points of view in each section, and then within those points of view are two sections, one in the real world and one in Palimpsest.
Sure.
So there ends up being series of four and eight.
Yes.
So
musically,
very, very musically. And you're right, there are colors attached to each character. Colors are a big obsession of mine. I studied medieval color theory, and so whenever I can start riffing on my favorite color themes, I always do. Casimira, who is the matriarch of Palimpsest, her dominant color is green, and so wherever green occurs in the novel, it always harkens back to Casimira. And November, the character that becomes the most attached to Casimira, is sort of surrounded by green in all of her life, that sort of corrals her and leads her towards Casimira.
Yes.
The book that she loved as a child deals with green, the green wind, and the green clothes, and all of these sorts of things. And it's supposed to echo Casimira a little bit, because the woman who wrote that book, it's implied, went to Palimpsest.
Well, but as a novelist, to what extent do you revolt against this particular structure? You obviously have quite an imagination here, and so as a result, you have this sometimes rigid but necessary structure, and in the case of The Orphan's Tales, well, this is a scenario in which you planned it as one book and it became four books.
Mm-hmm.
So given these realities, it's almost as if structure is certainly helpful as a starting point, but simultaneously you've got the expanse of what your imagination does when you sit down at the computer to write.
Well, I think restriction is something I really thrive on. I think all art thrives on restriction to some extent, and I love setting myself up little prisons that I can break out of, because that is always a dynamic thing. When you set up a structure, you set up a certain sort of pattern of behavior, and then break out of it. So within the Orphan's Tales themselves, it very much breaks narrative rules, but the outer structure is quite rigid, whereas in Palimpsest, the structure actually changes halfway through the book, where the real world comes first, and then there's a section in Palimpsest for the first half of the book, and as Palimpsest becomes more dominant in the characters' lives, the first section of each chapter is in Palimpsest, and the second is in the real world. So it actually flip-flops, which gives me two. So I have, you know, one side of the book and one other side of the book. So since I'm obsessed with numbers, I get to have, you know, two large sections of the book and four smaller, or I guess it's six smaller sections, then four sections in each section, then eight smaller sections, and I get to play with numbers all over the place.
All right. So here's the kind of random question out of the blue. Which number is your favorite, or maybe what are your five favorite numbers? Do you deal with this on a single digit scenario, or what?
I'm going to have to go with seven. Actually,
seven.
A little girl came to one of my Orphan's Tales readings. She came up to me after and said, "Why are there all those sevens in your book?" And I love seven. It's it's a prime number, and it's a typically mystical number, but it's fascinating to me. But I almost never use it in structure because it doesn't fit very well.
Yeah.
It's kind of an ornery number that way, which I suppose is why I'm attracted to it. I'm kind of ornery myself.
Yeah. Well, you know, Neal Stephenson told me that seven was the ideal number of guests at a dinner table. So.
Oh, wow. I hadn't thought about that.
I mean, what are the applications of seven, not just to your fiction, but also just to your general life?
Well, I guess, it's the number that I don't use, though. Seven is a number that doesn't occur in nature very often. There aren't too many seven-leafed or seven-petaled plants. You know, that is why it's a mystical number, because it exists outside of the world. And so I don't actually use it all that much. When I'm arranging things, I go with three, I go with four, a tremendous amount. And of course, four is a very thorny number in Eastern culture, because there's four noble truths. But four also means death in Chinese and Japanese. And so they will often, much as our number 13, consider it unlucky, remove it from hotel rooms and things like that. I love the number four, I love the number eight. But seven is like the number apart.
Yeah.
So I use it in fairy tales all the time in terms of time. 7 days, 7 years, 7 months. There's a character named Seven in the Orphan's Tales.
Yeah.
And that particular character deals with coins that have a seven-pointed star on them. But seven I love because it's weird.
What's your position on the Magnificent Seven or the Seven Samurai?
Oh, well, of course, those come from Seven Against Thieves, which is a wonderful ancient Greek play. I'm a classicist, so I always go straight back to that. And, of course, the Seven Against Thieves comes from the seven dragon teeth that Cadmus planted in the earth. And, Seven's great.
Okay, let's go back to the question of imagination versus structure. On a sentence-to-sentence level, to what degree do you revolt against this wonderful prison that you're working in? I mean, when you're working on a particular turn of phrase, are you thinking how you can turn that phrase in a manner that it works completely against the structure? I mean, or to what degree are you familiar with the flow of what you're working with, and to what degree are you lost within that particular flow?
Well, a lot of my process involves reading out loud. At the end of every day, I read what I've written to my fiancé, and that allows me to really pay attention to the flow, as you said, the flow of words in a musical sense, and to what extent I'm repeating things on purpose. I love repetition as a technique, and I use it constantly. It comes from my background in poetry and in ancient poetry. Of course, repetition is absolutely vital to ancient poetry because you had to memorize it. So when I'm constructing sentence by sentence, I'm usually trying to pay attention to how individual words echo forward and back. You know, there are vital words that, you know, like the word green, the color itself, but also the word that, like, this is why Mark Danielewski made the word house blue in House of Leaves, so that it would echo forward and back, and now none of the rest of us can do that.
The ultimate synesthetic book,
and it's an enormous favorite of mine, but of course he's taken that technique from the rest of us, and we can't do that, so we have to do it in more subtle ways. So I'm paying attention to how each word affects the rest of the book, and by the time you're at the end of a book, any word that's not a simple pronoun pretty much, at least for me, echoes all the way back into the book and means something. Context builds and accretes, and I love that effect, so that by the time you're on the last page of the book, there's nothing that doesn't mean something. There's a pun in like the second to last sentence of the book that deals with the entire context of Palimpsest, and I love being able to do that.
Yeah.
I don't like puns as a rule, but if they're serious puns, I can deal with it.
Serious puns? Is there such a thing?
Sure.
Or purposeful puns? That actually relates to an additional meaning?
You know, British writers love to pun just for the sake of punning, it would seem. And
why not?
I like puns that I only see on the second run. That's what it is.
Ah, okay.
Puns that jump out at me, I'm like, oh,
if it's a cheesy
Lord.
Pun, yeah. You're not... Yeah, okay.
Thank you. I really needed that to get through the book.
If it's an obvious pun or a pun that you can unfurl and you kind of groan at, it's not purposeful.
But if on a second reading I go, oh, I see that word.
Yeah, yeah.
Then I like it. Then I feel like I've opened a little present box.
Well, talking of numbers, I mean, are you aware of the number of letters in a particular word choice?
I suppose I'm not directly. I'm definitely aware of the length of the word, whether it's a short word or a long word, so like a short beat or a long beat in music. I'm certainly aware of The numbers for me have to do with sectionality, the breaking things down into small pieces. And actually, I think that comes from the fact that I'm a child of the internet generation.
Yeah.
And the way that blogs are traditionally structured is in discrete paragraphs instead of tabbed paragraphs. And so I think that reading that, all of us tend to think in much smaller compartments. Italo Calvino, of course, wrote the great essays on the literature of the new millennium, and he talked about how everything would be much more compartmentalized and much shorter.
Yeah.
And I don't think that has happened to the extent that he thought it would in 1986, but it has certainly happened to the extent that the way that we conceive of stories is as smaller discrete entities within a larger entity, because when you pull up a friends list or a blog roll, you see all of these stories that connect to make the big story of your social circle.
Yeah.
And everyone's telling stories from different perspectives, everyone's looking at politics and culture from different angles, and you accrete all of that in your own brain to make your worldview.
Yeah.
And so I think that that deeply affects the way I write and the way that I conceive of the world.
I'm wondering if you have a particular list or a set of outline or notes that you call up in the course of writing a novel along these lines, perhaps even a separate window. It almost seems that...
I
have a feeling if you're a child of the internet and you're as much of an internet junkie as I think you are, then I suspect that there may be, like, maybe a secret text file or something like that, but maybe...
This is where I am not any kind of model for other people's process, because I don't. I keep it all in my head, and there will come a day when I can't do that anymore.
Uh-huh.
But I never wrote a single note down for the Orphan's Tales for that structure. I never outlined it. I just didn't do any of that stuff. I kept it all in my head, and the same thing with Palimpsest. I used the program Personal Brain for a while, which is pretty cool. I'm a Mac user now, and it doesn't exist for Mac, so I haven't used it in a while. But it allowed you to... it had I'm going to make a gesture here with my fingers because you can obviously see that on the radio.
Yeah.
But it had a core circle that you could write whatever it is that brain was about, and then you could visually pull strings off of that circle.
Yeah.
And label them. And then I would maybe remind myself of what I wanted to get into that chapter that day or something. But I don't outline formally and never have. Haruki Murakami said that if he outlined a book, he would be bored by the time he sat down to write it. And I feel the same way. I try to move through the book as a reader would. I can't write out of order at all. That makes me insane. And I can't, if I pre-outline it, I have an idea of where I'm going. But if I pre-outline, then I feel like my brain thinks it's already done the work and doesn't feel any need to write the novel then, because clearly the novel exists whole in my brain and doesn't actually need to get out. So I have all these workarounds of my personality. So I'm fundamentally a very lazy person, and so I have to build these sort of complex structures in order to keep myself able to put novels out, because my brain will just assume it's done.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting, because I'm curious how long you take to think of a structure and outline in your head. What's the thinking process? Because a lot of people, you know, they just think about something and then they just, boom, it just gets written down. It's like transcribing.
Yeah.
And I suspect this is a similar situation for you.
It is. And it depends on the book. I knew the structure immediately for The Orphan's Tales, and I was pretty aware of the structure for Palimpsest. But there are some things that take much, much longer. It just depends on how obvious the idea is to me. And so, let's see. At Palimpsest, I wrote the short story, I guess, a year before I sat down to write the novel. But the minute I wrote the first sentence of the short story, I knew it was going to be a novel. I knew it wanted to be a novel. I wrote it for Paper Cities, which is an anthology edited by Ekaterina Sidia and put out by Census 5 Press. And the minute I finished the story and I sent it in to Ekaterina, I said, just so you know, I will be writing a novel about this from this story. And I thought about it for a long time and sort of... I wrote a proposal about... 6 months later, I think. So I had the basic characters in mind and the basic structure of it. And then once it sold, I sat down to actually write the novel. And by the time I'd sat down to write the novel, I had been thinking and organizing in my head for almost a year. And that is a tremendous amount of homework.
Yeah.
You know, it looks like it comes fast at the end, but it's that all the work goes on inside and not outside. By the time I'm ready to sit down and write a novel, it exists in nebulous form, not in the plot, because I don't outline, but in the feel of it, in the colors of it, in the numbers of it, in the sort of aura of the book, which sounds a little foo-foo, but, you know, books have colors and feelings to me, and once I can see it in the distance, and I can see what color its eyes are, then then I'm ready to sit down.
But accessing those colors and feelings, does this take time?
It's completely subconscious and intuitive for me. Like I said, you know, I think you have to eat a lot of semiotics for breakfast, and then by dinner you can sort of put out a very symbolic text, because I studied this stuff for years, and it's kind of like ancient Greek and Latin, which I also studied in school. So I studied it so long that it's a knee-jerk reaction now. It's just embedded in my psyche and part of how my brain works. And I don't necessarily have to say, well, what colors am I going to use to represent each character? Each character has colors when they, you know, when I invent them. It just comes with them. It's sort of a mild synesthesia.
It's a matter of balancing this semiotics that is imprinted upon your brain with the instinctive aspect of what a character or color is.
And of course, books can be overdetermined and far too full of semiotics. I think House of Leaves, as we mentioned, sort of sits right on the edge of the good side of that, the light side. But I think that there are plenty of semiotics in my book. There can't help but be because I wrote it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I also, you have to make something that is emotionally affecting. Otherwise, the semiotics don't matter at all.
Yeah.
You know, the whole study of semiotics is analyzing text that has already been proven to be a successful literary object. You know, Derrida studied Plato and analyzed all kinds of fictional texts, and those are already successful literature. I'm trying to create successful literature is sort of doing it backwards.
But here's the interesting question. I mean, to what degree do you have to essentially retool the innate semiotics in your head? Because if you resort to the same semiotics over and over and over again, there's the risk that your work might either become a repetition of itself, or it might become a scenario in which there isn't, I suppose, a natural evolution, or even this the idea of arranging what you tactilely feel, or what you see through colors and the like, that this may perhaps be lost in this, or even vice versa, that the semiotics may overshadow the sensory aspect.
So I think that's what life is for. You know, by the time that you sit down to write another novel, years have passed, or a year has passed, and you've experienced more. All writers have kinks. We all have things that we just can't stop writing about. As we talked about yesterday, writing on skin is one of them for me.
Yes.
And I can't not write about that. I'll probably be done with it at some point. I'll have, you know, purged that enough. But I do think of it like kinks, that there are things that turn us on and that we need to get through the book. We need to have that in there because it's almost a compulsion. But it's what surrounds those compulsions. You know, I can't hardly think of any writer that doesn't have some things that carry from book to book, and some things that compulsively carry. Stephen King, of course, you know, compulsively talks about the same kind of characters from book to book, but his books are drastically different. So I think that sort of the responsibility, if you're going to be a semiotically aware writer, is to live a really full life between novels so that you have a new set of symbols, of personal symbols, coming to each novel. Because that's all a novel is. It's a set of personal symbols that are trying to become universal. And sometimes they succeed and sometimes they don't.
But I bring up this question because Callum says the city in this book is very much a matter of semiotics and shifting semiotics. It's, in a sense, it's a topography that perhaps matches this topographical scenario that we're describing that is inside your brain. Mm-hmm. So,
there's
some awareness here.
Of course there is. Yeah. Of course there is. There's a tremendous amount of awareness. And what Palimpsest is a city that is trying, it is a sentient city and trying desperately to make everybody within it happy and give them what they want. And of course, what people want, going back to kings, what people want is not always the best thing for them. But I mean, I look around, we're in New York right now, and I look around and part of me feels like New York is the same way, that trying to juggle all of these competing desires for, you know, the people who want to make money in Times Square and the people who want to have a bohemian sort of poet's lifestyle, and trying to juggle all those things creates the city that as it is.
Yeah.
And Palimpsest is the same way. And of course, since Palimpsest is a dream city, dreams are the heart and soul of semiotics. I mean, they are pure semiotics. And so everyone brings their own personal set of systems to it. And because will and action are so closely related in Palimpsest, all of a sudden it's an explosion of symbols. But I think that all I've really done there is take an actual city and add a magical element to it, because I think every city is just a conglomeration of desire.
Yeah, but there's also this barren desire, because Oleg in this book bears himself at Times Square in order to find a way to sexually penetrate into Palimpsest.
Mm-hmm.
And this is interesting that this happens in New York, as opposed to, say, Benicia, or which we could talk about again, I suppose. But I am trying to vary this up. Mm. But that's interesting that New York causes someone like Oleg to be even more isolated and more unable to find someone that of his lifestyle, of his imaginative nature. Mm-hmm. That, you know, so there is this.
It's funny that you say that, because I never thought about it till right now, but I suppose this story, and especially Oleg's story, has something to do with my relationship to New York. Because the first time I came here, which was right, it was like 2002, I hated this place. I thought, I have never seen such a lonely city in my life. It's just soulless and empty, and people are just running around paying attention to their own things, and not, like, there's no connection with other humans here. I was totally horrified by it. And, you know, I did the Broadway thing, and I was here for 10 days, and I just wanted to go home so badly at the end of it. And a couple of years ago, I came again, and I really didn't want to, but if you're going to be a writer, you're pretty much going to have to come to New York at some point or another. It's like Mohammed in the mountain. But I came and I had a couple of friends here. I didn't have friends here when I came in 2002. And I stayed with them, and they showed me the things they really loved about the city, and I met a whole bunch of other people through the publishing industry and through my blog. And slowly, New York became the most soulful city, because I know so many people here, because I can see what their desires are. They wear it on their skin. I can look around and say, I know that frozen river, and I know that subway system. I know how to get there. And it's part of my internal map now.
Yeah.
And that progression from the first time you enter a city, especially a large urban landscape, where it seems like the loneliest thing in the whole world, to what it really is, which is this glowing network of connected humans, is the story of Palimpsest.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting, too, because also one might argue that one's relationship with a city or one's relationship with any kind of topography is subject to one's individual sensibilities, individual inclinations, individual desires, and all that, that there is no prescriptive formula for how one consorts with a city.
Exactly. And you know, that takes place in Palimpsest, too, and there's a character named Claire who tells the main heroine, you know, don't ruin this for us just because bad things happen to you there. For some of us, it's just a big party. And people deal with palimpsest differently all over the place. And for some people, it's very easy, and for some people, it's very hard, just like any city. It depends on how you enter that city, you know, by what way, with what sort of class structure, with what money. And I think that's true of any place. You know, there's a new genre of urban fantasy, and I say that because the old genre of urban fantasy has nothing to do with the new genre of urban fantasy. And originally, there was some talk of marketing this book as an urban fantasy, as paranormal romance and urban fantasy. And while I don't consider myself an urban fantasy or paranormal romance writer, I kind of liked that idea, because if it's a paranormal romance, it's a paranormal romance between a human and a city. And I dig that.
Yeah.
And I feel like every time I travel a tremendous amount, both for my books and for pleasure. And I feel like every time I enter a city, it's a paranormal romance. It is me learning to love this city. It is a courtship. And oftentimes the city is on the offense with that courtship. It depends on the city. But I feel like I, bit by bit, step by step, across the country and the world, I create a network of lovers that are the great cities that I have been in.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting, too, because talking about classification, well, I mean, have you been pushed, like, say, into new weird territory at all? I mean, there
I
are
think,
commonalities between,
yeah.
I think, this and China Mieville's work as
yes.
well, and so that's why I present the question, but then also in light of the current publishing climate, which is now hacking away at Baroque or lively science fiction or fantasy?
I think of Palimpsest as a combination of science fiction and fantasy. I think of Orphan's Tales as fantasy. I suppose I would be new weird, except I think I'm too young for that. I think the new weird tends to be authors who are at least 10 years older than I am, and sometimes 15 or 20. You know, Neil Gaiman and Kelly Link and China Mieville, all of these are not writers of my generation. I admire them tremendously, but I am, you know, not yet 30. And so I think that new weird, I'm not sure. I do think that there is a new genre coming, and I hope to God we aren't stifled by what is happening in the publishing
yeah.
industry, because we're all running into the steel wall of the economy is failing, everyone's panicking. This is a terrible time to be a writer. But I think what will happen is that some of us will go to small presses, which, you know, are the homes of great literature in this world. Some of us will be able to continue in large presses. Some of us will be able to go back and forth. And I think that that, for me, is the model paradigm of being sort of able to float between presses, again, with sort of discrete, small units. I've never known a world where you could stay with an editor your entire life. I never expected it going into this industry. I never knew a world where you could sell, you know, real literature in drugstores. That was not how I ever grew up or expected things to be. So I guess I have a certain amount of zen about what's going on in the publishing industry right now because, well, I'm lucky to have gotten where I was. I'm lucky that anyone was willing to take a chance on a very strange writer who was writing things that had nothing to do with what was popular right then. And if I can't be grateful for that luck and hope that it holds just a little bit longer, you know, just a little bit further, just let me work a little bit harder, then you know, I should probably just get a job as an accountant or something because it's a lot more secure in income than what I do.
Yeah, but then you're dealing with this dwindling publishing climate, and if we have authors going to small presses, I mean, how can you expect to devote considerable attention to working on a Baroque novel, because you have to have a year of thinking here?
Well, but you can think while you do other things. You can multitask. You know, we're back to the internet generation,
yeah.
And small presses are in part viable because so many of us have blogs and audiences and ways that audiences can keep in touch with us and feel as though that they're a part of our career and our world and feel personally invested in it. That is a level of success that even, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, was not possible. And I do need a year to think, but I can write another novel while I'm thinking about the next novel.
Ah, okay.
And I write very fast, and I think that's a very important skill in today's climate. Part of the reason, I've only been publishing for 4.5 years, and part of the reason that I've been able to do as much as I have, and I've published 11 books in 4.5 years, is that I write tremendously fast, and I can keep product in the marketplace. And that sounds really mercenary, but I'm also moved to write that fast, so you know it all kind of balances out. And you can't, the short-term memory of the world is getting shorter and shorter. You can't let your name drop off the face of the planet for a year or 2 years the way you used to be able to and still have people can't wait for your next book. It doesn't really work like that anymore until you get to the higher echelons like George Martin and things like that.
Yeah.
And you know what? I'm probably never going to be there, and I'm comfortable with that.
But have you announced your intentions here with the new weird proposal to steer a genre? That's pretty bold.
Know,
I mean, you're writing prolifically enough here. I mean,
you know, honestly, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I wrote a jokey little post on my blog, and I called what I do mythpunk. And there's a con about mythpunk now, and people have actually taken that up and used it as a viable way to describe the new weird kind of work. And I got an email a few weeks ago from somebody who wanted to do an interview about mythpunk, and they were like, and they had no idea that I had invented that term. It had just come full circle, and I was like, well, here's the blog post if you want to read how it started. So am I, I don't even think I'm the first person to say new weird, so I'm not announcing any intentions.
No, you're not, but I'm just trying to see, but we got mythpunk here.
Yeah.
Mythpunk is here on the record.
I, you know, using the word punk is sort of gauche these days. Nobody likes to do that with steampunk and cyberpunk and everything else. People feel it's overdone, but I love the word punk. To me, the word punk equals anxiety. It equals rage and power and a violent new art form, and anxiety toward whatever the dominant paradigm of that day is. So, you know, cyberpunk is anxiety towards computer technology.
Well, you're getting more into emo territory, I
would
argue.
Oh, no. Well, emo punk is probably the next big thing. Be anxious about emo. But
myth emo.
And steampunk is anxiety stored towards steam technology. So mythpunk is anxiety toward myth and engaging in a almost violent way with mythology and folklore and the dominant mythology and folklore of our culture. And I love that. I love what that word implies. Is every book I write mythpunk? No, palimpsest has nothing to do with mythology. But I think I write in the Catherine Valenti genre. And that's, I honestly think that with discrete units, with the way that we sort of conceive of culture these days, most of us are a genre of our own. Like an army of one, I'm a genre of one.
Yeah.
And I think that that's probably a really good thing. I don't necessarily want to specialize down to the, you know, how many periods somebody uses in a novel the way that bookstores want to, you know, within the aegis of realism or non-realism, I want to be able to find any number of things, and I want people to be incredibly personal, incredibly specific in what they write. And so that's what I look for. I look for somebody who wears their kinks on their sleeve in their books.
Yes, but a publisher may very well go to you and say, well, hey, Kat, we love your stuff, but it ain't selling. We need you to go ahead and write something that's a little bit more marketable.
How you assume that hasn't happened already. I'm working on a bunch of projects right now, and there are a couple of them that are more that are much more along the accessible spectrum, which is my new most hated word, the word accessible, than my previous stuff. And I just have to find ways to make me not want to kill myself when I write things like that. Not feel like I'm completely abandoning what I think is important. And of course, that comes with how you write, what you write, how personal it is. I'm working on a book about my time living in Japan and my marriage right now. It's very, very accessible, nearly chick lit, one might say.
Yeah.
But I am a chick and I do write lit, so I suppose that's not the bad word that we all make it out to be.
For some, unfortunately.
But at the same time, I'm also working on a trilogy about the myth of Prester John, which is a very obscure little piece of folklore. And it's got all kinds of multiple points of view and a complicated structure, just like I always love to do. So, you know, you work on more than one thing, and you work on your love, and you work on, love the one you have, love the one you're with.
What about, though, the modifier accessible makes you want to kill yourself? What specifically are we talking about?
Because here? I think access is a ridiculous metric by which to look at books. The way people can interact with books and access books is going to be different from person to person. It can never be universally accessible. And it is the word that everybody uses when they want to tell me that my books are too hard to read. And maybe they are too hard to read. I don't know. They seem to be doing okay. But I feel like dumbing down for a mythical audience that I don't know anything about, because my fandom is very strong and very vociferous, and they love my books. So it's hard for me to say, well, I'm going to play to the back seats of the people who didn't like anything I wrote before. I'm going to change everything I am for people who didn't like me in the first place. That's difficult for me to say. But I also believe in being versatile. And so I try to paint with a lot of different colors, and maybe something will stick. But the word accessible is overused in my little world to a drastic extent.
But I'm suggesting here that maybe it's a matter of taking back the word accessible and saying, well, these people who dig your work, who dig complicated books with intricate structures, they find this accessible. It's just the rabble, so to speak.
It's not rabble. I mean, I hate words like that imply a sort of class divide in reading. I didn't grow up the wealthiest girl, and I write these books. I think you're right. There is certainly a redefinition of accessible that could happen. I'm just working on writing the best things that I know how to write. And I think that's all anybody can really do. And will somebody publish them? Well, God, I hope so, because I love to eat. But if not, then I start my own press. Then I publish it online. Then I find some other way. This is a very wide and wonderful world, and there are a lot of ways to get story out there. People are addicted to stories, whether it comes in books or on television. People are addicted to it. You can't live without it. And so you find other ways to get it out there.
I wonder if you think that part of the problem may be the failure on behalf of some publishers to have what I have called geek outreach, to essentially realize that, I mean, if the sales of comic books, graphic novels, and even genre are any indication, that there is a huge audience for different kinds of stuff. And some publishers may not necessarily understand that audience exists, because the publishing industry is so parochial and so New York-based, they refer to anyone who lives in the so-called flyover states, which I loathe that term, as negligible. But in fact, these people, there's a potential fan base there.
Well, I mean, I think that to some extent that's inevitable. Geek culture is not mainstream culture by definition. And mainstream culture is what's going to get marketed to. Geeks have to sort of find little kernels of what they love in mainstream culture. This is why science fiction shows get canceled at a pretty brisk clip. I mean, there are just not enough hardcore geeks to matter to the publishing industry, and they haven't learned the lesson of discrete units yet.
Yeah.
But I have tremendous geek outreach, and I am a geek myself, and I move in those circles, and so it is my home, it is my people, my tribe.
Yeah.
So, you know, if they can't get on board with that, which, you know, considering that their response to the economic crisis has been to fire everybody and close down publishers, yeah. I don't really think they're thinking about how to make niche marketing really work.
Yeah.
Then somebody else will. You know, not to trumpet the capitalist system, because it's not my favorite thing in the whole world, but at some point there will be a vacuum and someone will step in.
Yeah. But it's also worth noting that 2008, the top grossing film, and I believe it's actually now outdone Titanic, was The Dark Knight.
Mm-hmm.
Geeks saw that.
Absolutely.
We now have a geek president in office, mm-hmm. one might argue. So I don't know if geeks are nearly as, I guess, marginalized as I suppose the publishers or other people feel them to be.
I don't think they're as marginalized as they used to be, but, you know, you can't dictate culture with an executive order. And massive corporations still own most of the distribution outlets of culture. And until that breaks down a little more, I don't think that it's really going to change all that much. I think that that when you have a massive corporation, it moves incredibly slowly. And so it's always 5 minutes behind where everyone else is. And by everyone else, I mean, you know, the people who are online and creating culture. I think that things are going to get worse before they get better, but eventually we'll probably have a more discreet and stronger system, one that's smaller. You know, the big bestsellers have been selling less every year, you know, but year by year, except for the big outliers like Harry Potter or Twilight, they sell less and less. The standard print run for books 50 years ago was 100,000 copies. Can you even imagine 100,000 copies for a mid-list writer now? It's absurd.
Yeah.
You know, but that world doesn't exist. It just is gone. And there are a generation of writers now who never even knew it existed to begin with. And that generation of writers will fuel the next wave.
Well, let's talk also about ebooks. I'm not sure if you saw Lev Grossman's article today, but he actually proposed that the publishing industry would be issuing patches as, to a novel. There would be additional patches.
Oh, God, that's horrifying.
That's horrifying to you?
Oh, it is.
The novel is a final
it
process
is.
That it isn't fluid?
It has to be. There has to be some final product. I don't mind. Like, let's take the Lord of the Rings DVDs for an example. So there are two final products, and, you know, like 2.5 probably. There's the theatrical cut, and there's the extended cut. I don't mind extended cuts, but there has to be something that everyone recognizes as the product. Otherwise, people can't react to it in the same way, and you lose the entire nature of art and literature, which is as a communal experience. As we have both seen this movie, we have a common language. We both read this book. We have a common understanding of that world. Like, to lose that is to lose, to me, the entire point of art. And I mean, boy, I could see how you could have fun with patches, but they have to stop at some point.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no way in my mind without losing that communality to make infinitely evolving novels.
This is fascinating because here you are arguing for the permanent and you've written a book about an impermanent city that constantly changes.
Well, but that, I mean, part of the communality, I hope, between that book and its audience is that the city in their minds will constantly change, but the book itself is at least somewhat permanent. And there are other bits of fiction that attach to the book that are available online through a sort of networked puzzle and things like that. And I, you know, at some point I may go back in the future and create other little bits of the city for people. But I hope, and I hope this for all of my books, that the book is the launching point for their experience, that it's a creation we make together between author and reader. And because of the networked world, they can have both. They can have that communality of experience, but in their minds, in their dreams, and I've already had people emailing me to tell them that they dream about this city and that it's real for them. It can be personal and experiential. But if I were to change this book, you know, every couple of months, I think that people would lose interest very quickly because they couldn't talk to anyone about it.
Have you received any propositions by email on where to find the people who have the black ink to actually...
Well, sort of, because we're running this puzzle I was talking about online. We're running this online game, which sort of posits that this whole thing is real. So occasionally I get emails from people who have gotten caught up in the game. And, all of the emails sort of have the same kind of message to them. I haven't personally gotten any propositions. I have a large tattoo on my back of the mark from this book.
Oh, really?
So when people see that, they usually make a crack about immigration or transmission.
Yeah.
But I'm a fairly intimidating person to most people because I don't look like a friendly little girl, so most people don't proposition me, just full stop.
Well, the interesting thing, too, is that perhaps with this book, if there is a game going on, that you might actually have there might be some interesting interest from a certain sexual community or whatnot.
Oh, and there is. There is. And this book is intended to be a book for the kinky and poly and queer community. People who are networked, which in the kink community and the poly community, people absolutely are, not only networked, but compelled by society to keep things secret, which is a very big part of palimpsest. This is a book for them. This is a book about their world, the world that's created when two and three and four and five people come together in a sexual union. They create their own vocabulary, their own terminology, their own customs, their own geography, their own ways of interacting with each other that are a small world, a world in microcosm. That is absolutely the core of this book. The central metaphor is that sex is the creation of a country, that every sexual participant is an immigrant.
E-books, I had posed that to you. Do you have any particular position on that? Would you be disappointed if, for example, Palimpsest came in on a Sony e-reader or what?
Well, but it does. You have to sell e-rights to publishers. They don't really give you a choice on that, and they don't really give you any money for it either. But it will be in e-book form, so you can have it on your e-reader. I have an e-reader. Would I be disappointed? No. I love books as objects. I understand not everyone does. I would be disappointed if we enter a world where ebooks are the dominant form, but I'd live with it. You know, I think that for some of us, the physical book will always be important. Probably given 20, 30 years, I think I'll be well into my middle age before this actually happens, but physical book publishing will probably become a niche specialty industry, down the line. I think it's much further down the line than a lot of the proponents of ebooks think it is. I have my Sony e-reader, and it's got a lot of issues. I mean, it is hardly perfect, and I did have to spend, $400 to read a book instead of, and then buy the book separately. Instead of spending $12.95 to read a book in the store.
And all that goes to Sony as opposed to, say, the publishers.
Right.
I mean, essentially with the Kindle, you have Amazon bankrolling and subsidizing the publishers by...
But Amazon also has... I mean, I don't want to get into the geek tech hour here, but Amazon, the Kindle also has a lot of issues with dealing with doc and PDF files. Yeah. They want their proprietary file format, and which is why I have an e-reader and not a Kindle. So, yes, do I think that's the future? Yes, probably. Am I a little bitter about it? Yes, actually, I am. But at the same time, there are always going to be people who want to hold that book in their hands, and that's fine. My issue with ebooks right now is that there is a certain section of writers and ebook publishers who just publish in ebook format. And the fact is, it doesn't cost anything to publish in ebook format. So the signal-to-noise ratio is just a mess because there's no risk. I can publish an ebook for no effort. I could do it this afternoon. And so there's no risk to me if I publish a terrible ebook. So until there is some kind of punishment for being bad, I don't think ebooks will actually be any kind of benchmark of quality. Nobody goes and says, wow, I wonder what the new ebooks are. Because the newest ebooks to come out on the internet are self-published. They are unedited. They have, if they have any kind of art at all to them, it's terrible. They are not good quality. And while the system as it stands in the publishing industry of, well, if it sells, it was quality, is also not perfect, it produces a much higher sort of benchmark, to use that word again, I lost the word I wanted, than publishing for free.
Yeah.
And so I think until that changes, and that's very different from like what Cory Doctorow does, for example, which is to publish in both ebook, free ebook and not free paper format. And I think that is certainly the bridge between the two worlds. But to publish just in ebook format right now is a very problematic thing.
But for some authors, I can even name one, Eric Kraft, who is a marvelous writer who has spent the entirety of his life writing about this character named Peter LeRoy over the course of 10 or 11 volumes. And he has, unfortunately, because of sales, seen his wonderful output essentially dip. His books are not in print. Mm-hmm. And so he has been forced to go to, say, the ebook format
I may be there too in a couple of years. But the thing is, it's very hard to find Eric Kraft's books and my books and things like that in the giant white noise of all of these completely unedited, completely unvetted in any way novels. So that's the problem. How do you get those novels out? And that is what the publishing industry does for us that nobody else can do. It's distribution.
Well, the vetting process in relation to your... I mean, we were talking earlier about this book and some of the struggles that you were having in terms of, will I actually be publishing in a few years? And this is interesting to me because, let's say the vetting process changes and they say, well, no, we don't have a market anymore for Baroque fiction.
Mm-hmm. That's already happening. Yeah. That's very true. Well, you go to small presses, you make, it's the discrete units thing again. You try to find somebody, and if you can't find anybody, you start your own press.
Well, Kat, thanks very much for chatting. It was a pleasure chatting with you.
It was a pleasure chatting with you.